Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wanted, seasoned bank executive. Must have background in high finance and financial scandals. Experience in rebuilding reputation would be handy too. Inquiries care of Bank of America, Charlotte, North Carolina. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 1,600 universities and colleges teach and manage 10 million students with software from SunGard Higher Education. More information at sunguard.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 1st of October. Glad you could be with us. We are not going to have Ken Lewis to kick around anymore. The CEO of Bank of America announced yesterday he will step down at the end of the year. 2009 has not been the smoothest of rides for Mr. Lewis or for the bank he runs. He has been criticized heavily, too, for BofA's role in the credit crisis and, in particular, how he handled the acquisition of Merrill Lynch last fall. But Lewis also built Bank of America into one of the biggest banks in the country. And that size means that whoever gets his job may not have an easy time of it. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Ken Lewis's successor won't just be the head of a bank that's too big to fail. He or she will lead a bank three times the size it was when Ken Lewis took over in 2001. Here's Celent banking analyst Bart Narder.
15 years ago, the top five banks had about 11% of all deposits. Now there are three mega banks in the U.S. that have 10% or more of all deposits. Bank of America is one of them.
And its portfolio is quite a bit more complex than it was, especially with that controversial acquisition of the investment bank Merrill Lynch.
It's a dramatically different business. And to be an excellent retail banker doesn't make you an excellent investment banker.
The new CEO will have to be both, and even being both won't make the job easy. Christopher Whalen of Institutional Risk Analytics says next year will test the nerves of everyone in the banking sector, even those who've already accepted toxic asset losses on paper.
We're going into a period now of realized losses. This is mostly on loans, but it's also on securities, where the bank is saying, well, I'm not going to get my money back. That's a very tough thing for banks to do.
Well, do you think that they've been too optimistic when it comes to how much money they are putting aside for losses?
Oh, definitely.
And remember, Bank of America still hasn't paid back the $45 billion it borrowed from taxpayers last fall. Whalen says all that adds up to a tricky changing of the guard at B of A.
And it's a little troubling, frankly, that Lewis would resign before they had a successor in place.
Investors didn't seem thrilled with any of the potential candidates floated today. Bank of America's stock fell more than 4%. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On the topic of the finance industry, the debate over how to protect consumers from its excesses is getting some attention in Congress. Both the Obama administration and a lot of Democrats on Capitol Hill want to create something called a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. The idea would be to keep abusive mortgages and credit cards off the market. But that being Washington, not everybody sees things the same way. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is lobbying hard against the agency, saying it's going to cost jobs in an already lousy labor market. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
About a month ago, the Chamber of Commerce started running ads like this one.
The so-called Consumer Financial Protection Agency is not about consumer protection. It would create
The chamber says it's really about creating a big bureaucracy that could stop your butcher from offering you a line of credit. Democrats said that was a misrepresentation and clarified the point by tweaking the bill.
It takes out the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker.
Gail Hillebrand's at Consumers Union.
And so now the chamber is switching gears and trying to find some other way to say this will be bad for business.
The new argument is that a federal consumer financial watchdog would cost the economy jobs.
This is not the time to do that.
Tom Durkin's a former Federal Reserve Board economist. He wrote a study for the chamber noting that millions of small business people use their personal credit cards, home equity loans, even pawn their car titles to raise cash.
I mean, we don't want to raise costs and expenses for small business. If anything, we want to make it easier for them to have access to credit that they need.
But Durkin believes the proposed watchdog would increase the cost of credit to small businesses and stifle job growth. How that would play out is unclear.
You don't have any firm conclusions on that right now because you don't know what the agency would do.
Still, the chamber's using Durkin's study to argue the proposed agency would cut off credit to small business, perhaps even killing the next Hewlett-Packard in its garage.
It's just not true.
Gail Hillebrand from the Consumers Union.
The study makes an assumption that if abusive practices are stamped out, small businesses won't get credit, but it doesn't back that up with any facts.
Hillebrand points out that small businesses are also hurt by abusive lending. In fact, many of them pushed for recent credit card legislation in Congress. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Here's today's economic report that makes you go, come on, seriously? The International Monetary Fund says the trillions of dollars that have already been spent worldwide on economic stimulus might somehow not be enough. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
One of the most discouraging assessments in the IMF's progress report is that we're still only about halfway through the agonizingly slow unwinding of the banking crisis. So far, the IMF reckons only around 50% of all those distressed assets have been written off by banks in the U.S. and Europe. Citing those and other lingering uncertainties, the IMF advised governments today to thus stand ready to roll out new initiatives, should they become necessary. Jose Vinales, who watches capital markets for the IMF, spoke at a briefing in Istanbul.
If we fail to meet the challenges still being faced by the financial system in the present crisis, we risk reigniting systemic risks and even derailing the economic recovery now in train.
One stubborn drag on stimulus efforts and the nascent recovery is that banks keep cutting back on their lending under the burden of the risks still lurking on their books.
If the question is whether banks have enough capital to supply sufficient credit to support the recovery, we believe that the answer is no.
It may be prudent to be prepared to deal with a worsening scenario, but Colin Bradford, a senior fellow on global economic development at the Brookings Institution, thinks sounding the alarm now is premature.
If bank credit really does begin to freeze up again, and if unemployment shoots in the United States well above 10% and keeps rising, then you go back to the drawing boards and say, do we need more stimulus, and if so, what kind, and so on. But the facts aren't in yet enough.
Bradford says spending more money would be a tough sell with the American people in Congress, even if things did take a turn for the worse.
It would be a tough sell indeed right now because of the fact that there isn't any evidence that the recovery is not underway.
The IMF report concedes that more stimulus spending could be ruinous for countries already deeply in debt. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The topic of economic recovery will be tomorrow's breaking news headline at about 8:30 Washington time. That's when we'll get the September unemployment report. On Wall Street this first day of October, well, I wish I had better news. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Aside from maybe socks and underwear, a pair of jeans might well be the most common article of clothing there is. No big deal for most people in this country anyway. In India, though, a pair of Levi's is a symbol of wealth and big city style, a symbol that is way beyond most people's means. But they are about to become easier to afford. Raymond Thibodeau reports now from New Delhi on Levi's on the installment plan.
One is skinny,
okay,
and one is mid-rise skinny boot. It's
at a busy Levi's store,
okay,
at an upscale mall in New Delhi, Reshma Gorpade is looking for a pair of skinny jeans. Here they run about $50, a small fortune in a country where the median income is about $100 a month.
It's my first pair of Levi's.
Levi's launched its jeans by installments plan, mainly to lure first-time buyers like Gorpade, a 25-year-old office administrator. The tactic appears to be working better than expected.
Yeah, I might buy two now. I came in for one, but I might buy two now.
This jeans by installments plan has been so successful in boosting sales that Shimon Chatterjee, director of Levi Strauss India, expanded it from one pilot store in Bangalore to dozens of stores in nine other cities. Now he plans to widen it to include hundreds of outlets in smaller towns and villages across India.
We came up with this idea because this has really worked for home appliances, cell phones, televisions. So we said, why not, you know, use that insight and apply it to a pair of jeans from Levi's.
The plan's limited to shoppers paying with plastic. Levi's has tie-ins with local credit card companies so that its customers won't have to pay any interest. Chatterjee says credit card companies are using these buy-now, pay-later incentives to tempt young people to apply for credit cards. India is traditionally a largely cash-based economy, but analysts say the growing acceptance of credit is fueling a new trend. Brand name retailers and credit card companies are starting to target lower income shoppers as India's consumer culture expands into less wealthy rural areas. There are spin-off benefits of this new trend.
It promotes growth, it promotes opportunity.
That's Michael Spence, a Nobel Prize-winning economist and director of the Commission on Growth and Development, a UN-sponsored think tank. He says that as people in India's rural communities are able to buy more goods like cars, computers, and blue jeans, job opportunities in sectors like manufacturing will increase.
Because somebody's going to make them, and they're probably going to make them here. I doubt if Levi's is going to make them in Oakland or San Francisco.
But he also sees risks as glitzy shopping malls spread to the countryside, and credit is extended to millions of low-income Indians.
Well, you can overdo it, as we just demonstrated in the United States. There is a little bit of consumer protection that's required in this.
As well as some consumer education about things like interest rates and how to avoid the kind of debt madness that many believe caused the global economic meltdown in the first place. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Dow Industrials fell more than 200 points today. Crude prices slipped just a little bit. I think hog futures were off as well. And I could stand here and try to explain why, but the fact is we don't really know why the markets do anything. The last year and a half have given lie to what was once the dominant idea for how those markets worked, something called the rational markets theory. So now economists are looking for a new way to explain why the markets do what they do. Here to explain it to us is John Authors. He's the investment editor at the Financial Times. Mr. Authors, good to have you with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
We had thought for 40 or 50 years that we had a pretty good handle on how the markets work, didn't we?
Yes. In the early 1950s, there were a series of big breakthroughs in academic economics, a number of which got rewarded with Nobel Prizes, which left us thinking that we knew that stocks were the best investment for the long run and that everything did seem to be very clear.
Until it got very unclear the past year and a half or so. What the heck happened?
Well, it wasn't so much unclear as total unequivocal refutation of all that we had held dear. I mean, there are certain parts of efficient markets that everybody knew were always an abstraction. Stock market moves aren't completely random. Everybody knows that occasionally you get into big bubbles and occasionally you get into big busts. I think the single biggest problem that you had last year was that everything was built around this very highfalutin notion of diversification, which is a more complicated way of saying don't put all your eggs in one basket, spread your risks around. So people invested in far beyond the stock market, in bonds, commodities, and they all went down together. What people discovered they had done was in fact make the same bet many times over when they thought they were spreading their risks, and that means that the investment industry really is without a rudder at this moment. The means by which they had navigated through risk and return are obviously not working anymore.
Well, as they grope around for a new rudder, a new steering mechanism, what kinds of ideas are they throwing up on the wall and seeing if it sticks?
One of the ideas is to look in terms of risks as opposed to asset classes, that different asset classes may actually be exposed to exactly the same risk. So you need to look at what you are scared of and then try to work out how different asset classes would respond, rather than simply thinking, if I've got 60% in stocks, then I can put the rest of my portfolio into bonds and I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. If you have an event that happens that causes both of them to go down together, you haven't helped yourself. Now, the other key thing about ideas, and there are various other variations of the theme going around, is people now accept you're not going to get a clear mathematical number at the end. You do not have my risk equals X at the end of this. Right. We need to make much more room for human judgment.
Well, you have this great line, actually, in the article you wrote in the paper on this the other day. You say that, you know, economists and these investor guys, they all have what you call physics envy. They want this clear formulaic definition and be able to plug numbers in and come out with a result. So why do we need a theory? Why can't we just let the markets do what markets do, which is just sort of go about their daily thing?
The markets are too important to leave that way. We have, in the last half century or so, entrusted all kinds of things to markets that were previously left to human judgment. For example, money market funds have taken over some of the functions of banks. The commodity markets at one point were left to specialists who actually knew about the economics of pulling oil out of the ground. Now that is much more left to financial markets. At one point, maybe we could have just left markets to go their own pretty way. The genie is out of the bottle now. I don't think we can do that. Whether we can analyze them with the kind of precision we'd like to, it may well mean that you need to go into the kind of really esoteric ideas about chaos and turbulence that physicists haven't been able to apply to thermodynamics yet. Whether we'll be able to is another matter, but I do think that we have to try.
John Authors is the investment columnist at the Financial Times. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, textbooks go high tech.
I think that they're going to be able to start adding in videos or, you know, links within the textbook. They'll get more and more interactive and just get better and better.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials tumbled 2% today, 203 points, closed at 9,509. The NASDAQ plowed down 3%, 64 points, ended things at 2,057. The S&P 500 slumped 2.4%, and its 25 points closed at 1,031. Airlines hit some turbulence today after United Airlines said it's going back to the capital markets to raise some money. The company's shares plummeted 21%. U.S. Air, American, and Delta all lurched more than 9% lower. Continental barreled down 8%. Banks tumbled as CIT Group announced it's readying a prepackaged bankruptcy plan. The lender's shares dropped another 12% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 3.1%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Date Book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The International Olympic Committee is expected to announce the future host city for the 2016 Summer Games. Chicago, Tokyo, Madrid, and Rio de Janeiro are all in the running. The United States Labor Department releases its employment report for September. And on this day in 1950, Charles Schulz's Peanuts comic strip made its debut to the delight of children everywhere. I'm Kevin Ferguson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Never fear, strange robots have not taken over this broadcast. It is just our friend Kevin Pereira from G4 Television here with the latest gizmos. I'm told this has something to do with music, Kevin, but you're not going to make me sing, are you?
No. Well, right. I mean, unless you want to.
Yeah, no.
I mean, we could auto-tune you. We could get you in the ballpark of Britney Spears.
I'm not doing that.
In a minute.
What have we here? You've got describe this these things for me.
Right. I have a couple different devices, Kai, that I think can help anybody, the aspiring musician, the home professional. the college student who just wants a way to wow his buddies. Doesn't matter. Three different devices of all different price points that can help you make sweet, sweet auditory love to somebody's ears.
Just what we need from you. All right, so this yellow thing, it's about the size of what, two packs of cards put together?
Just about. This is the Korg K oscillator, and this is a dynamic phase synthesizer, which basically means it's a battery-powered, portable synthesizing device. So it can play piano notes. You can have it do little... Wow. Pretty little synth noises.
On a little touchpad there.
It's all touchpad-based, and you can actually hit the scale button, and so you can lock yourself into a scale that sounds nice, so you can just play only the notes that you want to go along with the track you're playing.
Latest development in the digitization of music.
Yeah, some say, I mean, this is a Korg recognized, they have larger devices like this Chaos Pad here, which we'll get into, that cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars and have all these effects. And they realize that musicians now, they want to be able to make music anywhere. So if you have a laptop and a little K oscillator, which is a travel combo that I have, much to the TSA's chagrin, but this tiny little touchpad portable device, you can take it on the road, plug it into a laptop, plug it into a tape recorder, and make a full song.
All right, I'm sure you're a very talented guy, but what about real musicians making music with these kinds of things?
Actually exists. People do it all the time. I've interviewed on Attack of the Show. I've interviewed everybody from Crystal Method to Daft Punk, not just electronic bands, rock bands as well, that say that they take these to sort of experiment with ideas while they're on the road. Because this device, yes, it has synths, but it also has basses. It also has drums. It also has voices programmed into it. And so you're looking at about $100, powered by four AA batteries, or you can plug it into a wall and... Ta-da, you're making music.
Am I getting jiggy with it?
You were slapping some funk on it, they say.
So could you, like, record your voice tracks into a computer and then get it onto this thing and manipulate it somehow?
This device, this handheld device isn't so much made for sampling. But if you want to take it to the next level, which is using your own tunes, your own samples, your own music, then you have to step it up and go to the big brother of this, which is the Chaos Pad.
Which is right here, which is much more intimidating looking, I have to tell you.
This thing looks like an angry robot. 1,000 blinking lights. It's got 8 different pads that you can macro to different functions. This guy here retails from anywhere from $200 to $350.
Yeah, you know, my temptation now is to say, oh, come on, how much is anybody really going to buy one of these things and use it? Except I said the same thing 2.5 years ago when you were in here with Guitar Hero and Rock Band, and look at how wrong I was.
Guitar Hero and Rock Band can make anybody feel like a musician. Yeah. These devices, you do have to have some sort of musical inclination to really get anything out of them.
Yeah.
But let's say $300, that's too steep of a price point to find out if it's something you're interested in or not. I have a $1.99 application for the iPhone or the iPod Touch called Bebot, and...
Get out. Seriously?
All right. Same exact thing.
Now is the time to ask, is there anything that phone can't do?
No. If there isn't an app for it, there will be, is sort of the adage.
All right, we're going to go out with a song that you made, I guess, on all these gizmos in like 10 minutes this morning.
It's why I was exactly 10 minutes late today. Sorry about that. But yes, you can hear all these devices being put to use in a matter of minutes.
Kevin Pereira, G4 Television, Attack of the Show. Kevin, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kyle.
There is an unwelcome visitor in a lot of classrooms this fall. That would be the U.S. economy. States are cutting education spending to fill their budget holes, and in turn, schools are cutting programs, bumping up class sizes, doing pretty much anything they can to cut costs. One option that has started to get some attention is digital textbooks. They can go beyond just what is printed on the page, and they are a whole lot cheaper than those traditional hardbound doorstops that students have been carrying around for decades now. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
We went through 4 of the 5 fundamental economic concepts. So let's now do the final concept, marginal analysis.
Brian Evans is an economics professor at Foothill College in Los Altos Hills, California. Today, he's teaching his students cost-benefit analysis, and he's taking a chapter from real life, his decision to use digital textbooks in his class this year.
Let's think for a minute about the decision to go from the traditional textbook to the online book that we're using. So I was raised, you got to get as much as you can for your dollar. Right? I don't care what it looks like, it's not a lot. So we'll just, do some rough ballpark numbers here.
Schools have been running some numbers of their own. Online textbooks usually cost about $20 per student. Compare that to $100+ for a traditional textbook. Right now, digital books are only about 2% of the textbook market, but they're catching on fast at universities, and now states are pushing them as a way for public schools to cut costs.
Starting this fall,
with high school and math and high school math and science, we will be the first state in the nation to provide schools with a state-approved list of digital textbooks.
That would be California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. This summer, California launched a digital textbook initiative the governor says could save schools up to $400 million a year. Schools could negotiate prices, and kids who don't have computers could use paper printouts provided by teachers. Textbooks are a $7 billion business in the U.S., so you might think all this talk of digital books would have publishers coming unglued. The Chronicle of Higher Education's Jeff Young says not quite.
The publishers do stand to gain here. Publishers have been trying since even the CD-ROM era to do some sort of version of their electronic textbooks.
Online books are a lot cheaper to produce than textbooks. No glossy paper or pricey color pictures. So most of the money coming in from online books is profit. And the text itself is just the beginning. Students can buy supplements, like an audio version, a hard copy, study guides on DVD. Sanford Forte is with Flat World Knowledge, which specializes in digital textbooks.
We thought that if we could offer the students options at affordable prices, that they would buy something. And in fact, the vast majority of students are buying something from us.
More than half of the students in Professor Brian Evans' economics class bought a hard copy of the textbook from the online publisher to use with the digital version. Evans says his students found online books a little clunky. Graphics sometimes don't show up, it can be hard to jump from page to page, and you can't take notes in the margin. Students have also complained it gets tiring to read off of a computer screen.
So I don't think it'll ever replace a textbook totally, but I certainly think it's going to grow. I think that they're going to be able to start adding in videos or, you know, links within the textbook. They'll get more and more interactive and just get better and better.
Publishers are busy making improvements so students can highlight text, take notes in the margin online, and share those notes with friends. The books will also offer practice tests that can instantly identify a student's trouble spots and help them learn. And teachers can modify the books to fit their lesson plans.
So, what do you think? Is it worth it? Do the benefits outweigh the costs?
That's in the eye of the reader. But as the technology improves, more budget-conscious schools and companies are starting to think outside of the book. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, social media has come to the holiday shopping season courtesy of Best Buy. Maybe you've seen those ads the company runs featuring its Twelp Force. That would be a mashup of Twitter and help.
Hi. I hate my phone. What do I do?
So here's the latest twist. You want somebody to buy you something for Christmas? All you do is sign up at the Best Buy website. You pick out what you want. You enter the email address of the person you want to do the buying for you, and he will get reminders that, for instance, Timmy wants a new bike. To which I say, forget about Timmy, forget about the bike. Daddy. Daddy wants a new car. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. I don't really want a new car. Today, the Dow dropped 203 points, 2%. The NASDAQ lost 64 points, 3%. I'm totally happy with my minivan. The S&P 500 fell 25 points. That is 2.4% there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, turning Macau into a gambling mecca.
With an extra thing that he's a very seductive man. Even when you have a room full of tycoons, he's really one of a kind.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.